There are a number of transactions that we can see on the Bitcoin blockchain that are address poisoning transactions, where it's someone who is basically looking at the blockchain, finding target addresses with lots of Bitcoin in them, and then generating a vanity address that has the same starting and ending characters. And then they're sending tiny amounts of Bitcoin from their address to the target address. They're hoping that these people are going to make a naive mistake and go back in their own transaction history and copy and paste the wrong address.
Hey everyone, joining me today is Jameson Lopp, Chief Security Officer at Casa, which is my solution for multi-sig custody. Go to casa.io/Natalie. Jameson, it's been a while since we've had an interview, so thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Not bad, though I just got recognized on the street, so that's always a negative data point for me and my privacy.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first time we talked, it was a couple of years ago, you went through your whole backstory, your swatting, and all that you went through to kind of make your identity as private as possible, but it seems like that's totally, now you're out there. Everyone knows who you are, and you KYC'd at the hotel, so what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still highly private. The most sensitive aspect, of course, of my privacy is my actual address where I sleep at night, right? Like, that's where you're really vulnerable. That's where, you could potentially get wrench attacked, kidnapped. People could be surveilling you, try to understand what your day-to-day activities are. So, I'm still very highly secretive about where I lay my head to rest. But on the flip side of that, I'm still out here, with my real name. Yes, it is my real name and my real face. And that does come with some exposure and security and privacy ramifications. So,
well, I'm curious. I mean, isn't it so hard to have your home be completely private and offline? Because I feel like I can Google anyone's address today.
Oh, yes. It requires just a level of commitment, resources, money, legal entities set up.
Really?
And then really, even after all of that initial setup to actually protect the, publicly registered property, to keep it out of, the hands of essentially governments and data brokers, the hard part and the final step is the never-ending lifestyle change, where you have to make sure that you just never associate your name with your address on anything, anywhere, because you have to assume it's going to get leaked and then sucked up by data brokers and sold.
Right. Even if you have an LLC and buy the home in the LLC, someone can track who owns the LLC, and there's a footprint everywhere, it seems.
Depending on how you set up the LLC, there's a lot of sophistication and options of how you do that. Though even today, there's a fairly controversial federal law that has gone into effect where it's the Corporate Transparency Act, and that's actually requiring you to go to FinCEN and essentially reveal the true beneficial owners of your LLCs, even if they are like anonymous. So it's getting worse. It's definitely not getting any better.
Yeah, I would love to get your thoughts on digital ID. But first, let's just talk about, it seems like there's been a wave of security threats in the space. I'm hearing about more $5 wrench attacks, people getting hacked. The other day in Chicago, I think there was a family that got kidnapped and they had to send $1 million worth of crypto. So just zooming out, I mean, what's going on?
This is one of the many curses of success. And I talked about a number of them recently, actually, in El Salvador, both from a technical level and from just a physical real world security level. So, those of us who have been in the space for a very long time and have been holding Bitcoin, of course, we're very happy to see the appreciation and the value of Bitcoin and a number of things that come along with that. Now we have many people in media industry or Bitcoin specific media. And that's because the entire ecosystem has grown. So we can have more opportunities, more employment. The downsides, though, are that there will always be some criminally minded element of the population. I'm pretty optimistic about this. I think the overwhelming majority of people are good, upstanding, moral people who don't want to hurt others, for their own personal gain. But there's always going to be some small single digit percentage of sociopaths, psychopaths, amoral people who are willing to hurt others. And so what we're seeing is that as the total population of people who are aware of Bitcoin, who are thinking about it, as that expands, as the price goes up, you know, these are two like complementary things, you know, as that total pool expands, the price tends to go up. But the price going up also attracts more people. And so on a relative percent basis, I think that, like, the number of criminally minded people remain the same. But on an absolute basis, because the total size of the population that's aware of this industry is growing, then so are the total number of criminally minded people. And so the absolute number of attacks is going up. You could probably make a case that, like, the relative number of attacks against all crypto owners is probably lower, but that's hard to measure in the first place.
Coin Stories is brought to you by Genius Group, a Bitcoin treasury company listed on NYSE American, ticker GNS. Genius is on its way to hodling 1,000 Bitcoin in its treasury while educating the world on a Bitcoin-first future. Genius is also launching the Bitcoin Academy with courses from the likes of Saifedean Ammous, author of The Bitcoin Standard. Join the launch waitlist via the QR code on the screen or the link in my show notes and receive the weekly Bitcoin Treasury newsletter, plus a chance to win a whale pass to Bitcoin 2025 in Vegas this May. Genius Group. Genius isn't measured in IQ. It's measured in Bitcoin.
It seems like there's more social engineering scams happening. The CEO of Casa, Nick Newman, shared that video of himself kind of catching the hacker and asking him all those questions. I highly recommend people watch that video. Recently, Larry Lepard's account on X was hacked. Luckily, no one stole any Bitcoin or, you know, anything that he owns, but they were able to socially engineer him through like a Calendly link. And so they're posing as journalists. What should people watch out for and be aware of?
Well, you know, basically, you should never trust any incoming unsolicited message on any medium, you know, whether we're talking email or Twitter DMs or Slack or Telegram, you know, whatever communication channels. And of course, a lot of these social engineers lately are just doing phone calls because I think that in the back of people's heads, they feel like when they're talking to another human, that that person's more trustworthy than just, you know, maybe a random Nigerian email scammer. But you can't trust any of it. And these days, especially with the rise of AI and deepfakes, you don't even really know if you're interacting with a human anymore, or if the human that you think you're interacting with is the one who is actually on the other side of that call. So, you know, any incoming message that you receive, if it is trying to elicit fear, if it is trying to get you to take some sort of action, especially related to any of your financial or communications accounts, you should be red flags. You should slow down. Because really what they're trying to do is they're trying to get you to speed up. They're trying to get you to jump through authentication processes to basically bypass your own security and essentially give them access to something. So you think of it as what has happened is, once again, this is another curse of success. We have successfully improved a number of the best practices and standards and security mechanisms in the whole Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, good example is taking your keys offline, you know, using hardware devices. And so while back 10 plus years ago, the biggest thing would be for hackers to go and, you know, hack into the centralized exchanges and basically run away with the hot wallets because everything was online. These days, so much stuff is in cold storage that the weak point is the human. It's your brain. So you have to think of it as a lot of the adversaries out there are not trying to hack your computer anymore. They're trying to hack your brain to make you successfully jump through all the security protocols that you have on your computers and other devices. And then once they get in, they can take over your accounts and steal everything that's of value.
Right. Well, speaking of hacked centralized exchanges, we saw a big one recently with Bybit. I think I was introduced to the term warm wallet. I still don't know what that is. Can you break down what happened? Because we recently got more information on it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a highly sophisticated attack, but that makes sense because this was the Lazarus Group, which is generally considered to be the North Korea-backed hacking group. Now, what appears to have happened in this particular case is that the hackers compromised a machine of one of the developers that worked at Gnosis Safe, which was the multi-sig software provider that Bybit was using for their multi-signature Ethereum wallet.
Like physically compromised? Like someone had to be at an office?
I don't know that we know exactly how they compromised. It's probably malware. You know, they probably did some sort of either social engineering or phishing, and then they got some sort of malware on that developer's machine. And so then the attacker was able to essentially get onto the machine, start looking around, and what they found was that developer had sensitive key material that was Amazon Web Service, like production API keys. And so what they did from there is they used those production API keys to deploy their own version of the Gnosis Safe front-end web application by basically overriding the Amazon S3 bucket.
I don't know what that means.
So, you know, this is a culmination of many technical weaknesses like stacked on top of each other.
It's kind of like when a plane crashes. It's not one.
It's not just
thing.
One
it's like
thing.
A million things that went wrong in succession.
Right. So, you know, I don't know so much about like what they're calling this warm wallet or whatever, but even if we assume that like they had all of the keys offline, there are complexities and as a result, security issues with doing complex smart contract transactions. And so in this particular case, what was compromised was not actually the keys, even if the keys were on offline air gap machines, which I'm not entirely sure of, this particular attack would still affect those because what they did is they compromised the front end. And so one of the weaknesses is that web applications are very difficult to secure. It's just a bunch of JavaScript code that basically gets downloaded from somewhere on the internet and shows up in your web browser, and your web browser just runs it. The thing about JavaScript is there's no integrity checks to it. So, you know, compare a like JavaScript web app to something like a desktop application or a mobile application. Mobile applications in particular are better secured from an integrity standpoint, because when that code is built into one piece of software, it's then cryptographically signed with a key that's owned by the organization and the software developers that wrote it. There's nothing like that for web apps. So whatever code is on whatever server, it just downloads it and runs it. And so this is why the attacker was able to just take the Gnosis Safe JavaScript app, modify a few lines of that code, which specifically targeted the Bybit wallet. It didn't target anybody else's wallets. And that's what was particularly devious about this. Like, if they had wanted to, they could have targeted everybody's wallets that was using the Gnosis Safe front end. But I suspect the reason that they didn't was that they probably would have got caught faster and got, you know, less money as a result. So they were waiting for, you know, the big whale to come in and use Gnosis Safe. And so essentially, you know, what it did is it said, oh, you're trying to interact with the Bybit wallet. Oh, well, you might be wanting to do a simple withdrawal transaction, but what we're actually going to do is we're going to swap out the message that is getting created for this transaction and turn it into a smart contract execution message that changes the fundamental like underlying properties of the smart contract so that it's no longer owned by this set of keys in a multi-sig, but rather it's owned by these keys that the attacker actually controls.
So it just like diverted the funds to another wallet, essentially, to the hackers.
Think of it as it changed the permissions and the authorization control of the wallet itself. And then immediately after that happened, they used their keys to withdraw all of the money.
Why didn't they take Bitcoin?
Well, because... And this is where the complexities of like EVM and Turing complete smart contracts come into play. Bitcoin is an incredibly simple and straightforward protocol so that when you create a Bitcoin transaction, everything that that transaction is doing fits usually within a few hundred bytes, if not a few kilobytes of data. So all of that data gets sent to your hardware device, Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, whatever. And these devices, even though they're incredibly low powered, like low computational power devices, they're able to parse all of that data and then display to you on the screen that says, you know, you're sending exactly this many Satoshis to this specific address. Mm-hmm. And so you can verify that all on this highly trustworthy, you know, air-gapped environment. When you're doing that with a more complex protocol, your transaction doesn't have all of that data. Your transaction is a much smaller amount of data, and it has to get interpreted. It's basically sending a command that has to get interpreted by the virtual machine of that network.
Oh.
And then the virtual machine has to figure out what are the state changes that are going to happen as a result of this. So wow. Basically, it's not possible to trustlessly, like fully for yourself, to know exactly what the result of an EVM style smart contract message is going to be, unless you're running that like full node yourself and you're sending the message to it and you're basically checking to see what the wow. state change is before and after. And so, of course, a tiny little air-gapped device that only really holds keys and does a few cryptographic operations, it simply does not have all of the contextual information necessary to know what the actual state change result is going to be.
So with Bitcoin, because you can verify the address, it almost prevents something like this from happening. But it does almost raise the concern that I think a lot of people might have who take self-custody. You know, how much do I actually need to check every single part of that address? Because I'm sure there are people out there who kind of, you know, they check the first few letters and numbers, the last few, and then boom, they send it. But how important is it to really verify that address? And is there a point of vulnerability with the hardware wallets themselves that someone might not be aware of?
Well, you know, if you go deep enough, everything has weaknesses, everything has trade-offs. But I would say you should check the whole address, you know, all 30, 40, 50 characters, whatever, especially if you're sending a meaningful amount. And I'm actually in the midst of doing some research right now around something called address poisoning attacks. And this is something that we just started to see popping up on Bitcoin, I want to say in the past 4, 5, 6 months. This is partially because it's so cheap to create Bitcoin transactions right now. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of transactions that we can see on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin blockchain, that are clearly address poisoning transactions, where it's someone who is basically looking at the blockchain, finding target addresses with lots of Bitcoin in them, and then generating a vanity address that has the same starting and ending characters. And then they're sending tiny amounts of Bitcoin from their address to the target address. And what are they doing? Why are they doing this? Because they're basically burning their own money. They're hoping that these people are going to make a naive mistake and go back in their own transaction history and copy and paste the wrong address. So this is why you should check the entire address.
Oh my gosh,
and you should not you should not copy and paste addresses like from your transaction history because of that.
Really? Well, so you should create a new address, right? Every time
you
make a transaction. But doesn't that just open you up to having a million UTXOs that you're going to have to consolidate?
Well, the UTXO problem is somewhat tangential to the address creation problem, because you could reuse the same address over and over, but every time you're depositing to it, it's creating more. So I wouldn't worry about that. It's also it's kind of related to the quantum computing issues that some people are starting to talk about recently, where, you know, if won't go into all of the details of like the different Bitcoin address types and script formats, but essentially when you spend money from a Bitcoin address, most of the time, most address types are safe from quantum computers cracking them until you spend from them. Because once you spend from them, you are putting the raw public key on the blockchain. And so if a sufficiently powerful quantum computer comes along, then it would theoretically be able to run something called Shor's algorithm that would be able to take the public key and reverse engineer the private key from the public key.
Well, so that's interesting because I've heard even Andreas Antonopoulos in some of his early talks saying that Satoshi's wallet will eventually be compromised by AI. And that's when we'll sort of know is when those coins move. Can you share your take on that?
Yeah, I actually gave a presentation last year at length about this. And unfortunately, I think it's worse than what Andreas said.
Really?
And the reason for that is, you know, this was a really long time ago when Andreas said that. So things have probably changed. But if I was a quantum attacker, I would go to the Bitcoin rich list, like, you know, top 10 addresses with the most in them. And what you find is that there's a number of exchanges out there, Binance, Bitfinex, Kraken, and more, and they're keeping their all of their cold storage coins in one address, and they're reusing the address. So they're spending from the address, so they've revealed the public key to the address. So if I was a quantum attacker, I could go and try to scoop up Satoshi's coins or really any of those old pay to public key Coinbase outputs from the very early days where the raw public keys were put on the blockchain and they weren't obscured behind other hashes. Or I could go and take 250,000 Bitcoin, you know, from the Binance cold storage because they've already exposed their public keys. So like, you know, which payoff, you know, makes more sense? I think Satoshi's coins are actually safer.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. This episode is brought to you by Casa, the leader in Bitcoin self-custody solutions, helping people like me secure their wealth with simple, powerful multi-key vaults. And now Casa is here to help businesses and governments do the same. Introducing Casa Business, a secure, easy-to-use three-key vault designed specifically for small businesses with team signing capabilities and a web dashboard. Regardless of the size of your business, start your Bitcoin treasury the secure way. Take control and protect your assets. Get 10% off your Casa plan at casa.io/Natalie. Next up, Speed, the fastest growing Lightning wallet in the world and my preferred way to send and receive sats. You can use Speed to buy Bitcoin, swap with stablecoins like Tether, and snag gift cards to earn rewards, all in seconds. Download Speed via the QR code or the link in my show notes. Use code COINSTORIES10 for 5,000 free sats. Are you ready to take control of your wealth, your Bitcoin, and your online privacy? The Bitcoin Way is here to empower you. Learn to take full self-custody and eliminate all counterparty risk. Learn how to set up and run your own node and upgrade your cybersecurity and build a fortress of privacy around your online activities and your Bitcoin. The Bitcoin Way specializes in personalized one-on-one training. Schedule your free consultation at thebitcoinway.com/Natalie. And finally, CoinKite, the one-stop shop for all your Bitcoin self-custody needs. Their flagship cold card wallet is the go-to for cold storage. Protect your Bitcoin like a pro. Visit their site and grab 5% off with promo code Coin Stories. All right, back to the show.
Okay, so for the average person watching this that might be getting a little bit nervous, and they do take self-custody, whether that's on their own or through a multi-sig custodian like Casa, I mean, how do you best protect yourself? What do they really need to know about sending and receiving Bitcoin and holding it for the long term?
Yeah, well, you don't have to worry about quantum computing yet. That's probably at least 10 or more years away. And some people think it may never happen. This is a highly contentious debate, but it's good that we're at least talking about it right now. And so, you know, yeah, don't reuse addresses for a multitude of reasons, really. You shouldn't be reusing addresses. But, you know, if you're using hardware devices and you are actually checking what is on those screens, then you'll be fine.
But if you reveal one public address, aren't you revealing almost all of them because they can all be traced back?
Well, from a blockchain analysis perspective, there's the whole issue of like tracing UTXOs via shared inputs and then stuff like that. But that's a privacy issue. It's not so much the security issue of some of these attacks that we've been talking about.
Okay. Is there anything you think people should really know when they're seeing kind of just an increase in hacks and attacks? Do you think that you know, for those especially that might be watching this and they're nervous about taking self-custody because it seems like maybe a custodian might be safer, more convenient. Some of them I hear are going to have insurance. I mean, what do you say to those people?
Regardless of whether or not you're doing self-custody or third-party custody, as long as there's a way to move the money, then there's going to be potential weaknesses and points of attacks. Mm-hmm. So I would say the majority of the social engineering that's happening right now, they're stealing from custodial accounts. You know, they're basically getting people to authenticate into and reset access to their exchange accounts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole idea that, oh, the exchange is better at keeping my coin safe than I am, I think that's kind of farcical. Because the exchange has to allow its users to be able to access their money. And this is why we're seeing some pushback from a lot of people. A lot of Coinbase users are actually complaining that they're getting locked out of their own accounts. And this is completely understandable because Coinbase is probably freaking out behind the scenes. They're like, we got to stop these, you know, social engineering scams. But how do you stop a valid authentication request from someone who looks like it's your real user because it is your real user, right? Mm-hmm. This actually gets into like the traditional financial and banking fraud territory, you know, where you know, people's traditional bank accounts and credit cards are falling into the wrong hands. And so the banking system basically has to come up with all these heuristics to try to fingerprint people and try to say, oh, this doesn't look like normal activity. So right. We're going to lock down the account. It's kind of funny how that's come full circle now. So you have to ask yourself, you know, who do I trust more? Do I trust myself more or do I trust, you know, some third party whose security practices I actually cannot verify? And so one way that I like to really distill it down and make it simple is that third party custody is somebody else's self custody. So if you look at like a Venn diagram, like you have all of the risks within self custody. Well, all of that is contained within a larger circle of third-party custody because third-party custody has all of the self-custody risks. It also has all of the trusted third-party risks where any of the employees or infrastructure at that third-party organization can be compromised. Whereas, you know, if you're holding it yourself, you don't have to worry about some other third party being compromised.
I still can't believe that a massive exchange that services millions of people holds all of the Bitcoin in like one cold storage wallet.
Well, I mean, it makes sense from a simplicity perspective. In one sense, complexity is the enemy of security. But there's so much complexity, as we already said, just within the protocols of using Turing machine complete programming languages and those types of networks. So, we do some things at Casa that I would say arguably make us better than that particular situation because it's actually similar to what Ledger Enterprise does with some of their improved signing mechanisms. But basically, you know, the problem with the Gnosis Safe web front end, like I said, is all that code just comes into your browser and it's all just running right there. And it's not, there's no integrity checks or real verifications. With Casa, we're not doing the web browser stuff. It's going through our mobile app, and that has its own rigorous set of code integrity and deployment and app integrity processes to make sure that like no single employee at Casa can make changes to the code. Like there's a lot of peer review and two-man rules throughout our deployment process. And also the fact that it's not just running on one machine. It's not just running on your phone. There's actually both the client on mobile app and back on our server side, or they're all checking each other's work, so to say. Mm. So there's a lot, many other pieces that would have to get compromised in our own setup for that similar type of outcome to happen.
That's interesting because before I became a customer of Casa, I actually assumed that a mobile app and anything on your phone is less secure.
No.
Your phone could be stolen. I assume if it's an app, it's had to go through, you know, Apple as the gatekeeper. So Apple has all the information. But yeah, I guess I was wrong about that.
It's complicated, right? Like in some ways, sure, you're on a device that can easily be picked up and stolen. But from a code integrity perspective, it's actually far better. And actually, mobile operating systems in general have much better security than desktop operating systems because they have this like containerization aspect. So it's you can't like compromise one mobile app on a phone and then like be able to compromise the rest of the mobile apps on that phone, for example.
I've spoken to some people who are scared of self-custody for a very conspiratorial reason, if you will. They believe that our devices, all of our computers have a back door and that when you download a software, let's say it's, you know, the Trezor software or something, that when you input the information and you're putting in your passcode, that everything, all the keystrokes are getting recorded, the screen is actually somehow getting recorded, and then essentially someone has your seed phrase and the information presented to you by the devices. What do you think about that? What would you tell people that are worried about that?
Well, it is theoretically possible. I mean, it's actually, we know it's possible. Like there are companies out there that do nothing but specialize in using what's called zero-day exploits, basically finding vulnerabilities that nobody else knows about in order to compromise, Apple and Android devices. And that's why, you may see on a regular basis, Apple pushes out something that's like, this is a very important, like required security update. That generally means we found this vulnerability.
So you should do those updates.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But I would say this is one of the reasons why we keep the vast majority of our keys, in a Casa multisig on these air gapped hardware devices. It's because of that edge case risk. As far as we know, like the number of people who actually have their phones completely compromised, it's probably in the like hundreds. Like we're talking, you have to be so important that nation state actors are willing to spend millions and millions of dollars getting these 0-day exploits and the software associated with them to specifically target you. So like, if you're a high profile dissident that is being targeted by nation states, then you should absolutely be worried about that. And you should not be running a normal iPhone or Android phone. You should be running something hardened like Graphene OS that is much more locked down, much more difficult to use, but much more secure.
Well, when you plug in a hardware device, you get prompted with these updates to download. So how do you know that it's safe and not one that's going to compromise anything?
Yeah, so that is also going to vary, from developer to developer, from software to software as to like how they do those integrity checks. Like I said, if it's a mobile app and you're getting mobile app updates, every mobile app has to be cryptographically signed with the keys that Apple or Google know belong to that organization. And so the assumption is, as long as those keys themselves have not been compromised, you can be sure that it's actually being deployed by the organization you expect. Desktop software is trickier. Desktop software sometimes, if it's sensitive software, sometimes the developers will do code signing on it. If it's like an iOS Mac OS software, I think they have the ability to do code signing and that's built into the desktop. But if it's like Windows or Linux or whatever, you would have to do some manual checks. Like you would have to look on the website and see like, can I find the GPG signature to against this specific software version? And this is where, nobody's going to do this. Yeah, it's like you have to run some command line stuff to say, like, does this signature match this hash of the software binary files?
Well, I've been prompted for those updates. And sometimes I'm too scared to, almost because of things that I've heard or read or previously compromised software versions of companies. I get nervous.
Yeah. I mean, any change to software can potentially introduce vulnerabilities. So there's no way to know whenever you're downloading and updating to new software There's no way for you to know whether or not there are new vulnerabilities in the code. But what I can tell you, just from a general software developer and security perspective, there's always vulnerabilities. Mm. Like, all software has bugs. Even Bitcoin had bugs in the early days. And the only reason that we've gone so far, over 10 years now without any major issues is because there's so many eyes on the code. And even then, there have been bugs in Bitcoin since then, mm-hmm. but thankfully they have been caught by people and fixed before they were exploited. So the short version is there's no such thing as perfect software. All software has bugs. If you don't update your software, then I can assure you, you have vulnerabilities, and really it's this cat and mouse game with this moving window, right? Where mm-hmm. the bad people are trying to find those vulnerabilities, and the good people are also trying to find them and trying to fix them. Mm-hmm. And so you want to keep getting the fixes, even though it's highly likely that you're going to be getting some new vulnerabilities, because at the very least, those will hopefully be vulnerabilities that the bad guys haven't found yet.
Right. What do you think is the biggest mistake that people make with their Bitcoin keys?
It's generally the backups. It's either not having backups or putting the backups in such an obfuscated setup and not checking it that they actually just lose them. And so we see something that we call treasure maps very often. And usually people do this for inheritance, but sometimes they just do it for their normal backup process. And so they basically create security through obscurity, create these multiple layers of either like splitting data up and putting it in different places, or, throwing different passwords onto things that they may have just made up and don't do a good job remembering or keeping backups of those passwords somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I would say that's really the most common thing is really just people locking themselves out of their Bitcoin because they don't have a great backup scheme.
I have to be honest with you, because I'm not super technical. I don't understand how there are so many password hacks. I thought that passwords are supposed to be encrypted and that they're supposed to be secure. And every day I get a notification, there is a data leak. You got to change this password. And it's like every website. I mean, it's hard to keep up with creating new passwords, and sometimes you end up forgetting. And so what's your takeaway for that?
Yeah, so this is because I think most developers don't know how to actually do password authentication properly. And so you don't know, whenever you're creating an account somewhere yeah. with a username and password, you don't actually know what they're doing with that password. Like, if they're doing it correctly, they shouldn't be saving your password. They should be salting it and hashing it and basically saving this obfuscated form of it.
Why don't
they? Because it's harder. Slightly harder. It's, like if for example, you have some new developer who's never built an app before or just doesn't have, the security training around the best practices for doing it, then they're probably just going to be like, okay, I'll just store the password and then I'll check against it when they send me the password. That's the obvious naive thing to do. So really, you have to assume that every website that you create an account on does that, or that they could have any number of other just sort of weak password storage schemes that can still be brute force and reverse engineered. And so you also have to assume that any information you give to a third party that goes into some database will eventually be leaked. And so what are you going to do? Because you have to create a username and password.
Yeah.
You use password management software to generate long, random, unique passwords, because if you reuse the same password in multiple places, then eventually when one service gets hacked and those passwords get leaked,
yeah,
I can tell you what's going to happen, because I've seen this for over a decade just operating web applications, is that we see what we call drive-by attacks, where basically someone will come in with a list of millions of username and password or email and password combinations, and just try them all. And they're doing this on every service that, you know, has anything of value behind it.
Just brute because, force. Yeah.
Because they know that people reuse passwords and that they're going to get into some small percentage of accounts.
I know, but if you do those complicated passwords, they prompt you, because you can't remember it, right? Unless you, I guess, write it down and you're very analog about it. It goes, do you want the password manager to save this? But then the password manager could be compromised. And it's like, it feels like there's no easy way to do this. Okay, we're running out of time. We're actually going to be doing a webinar on some of these topics with Casa, which I'm so excited about, and dive a little deeper. So before we finish up, just final thoughts, any takeaways you want people to have?
Well, you know, whenever I start talking about security stuff like this, I can understand that I think a normal person who's listening to it just feels very overwhelmed.
Yeah, I'm feeling anxious.
It's very scary. And I mean, the internet is a scary place. Like I said, vast majority of people are good, but especially on the internet, where essentially once you are connected to the internet, you know, there's suddenly millions of naughty people who are going to start knocking on your door. And so that poses a very interesting and challenging security landscape for those of us who run internet-based services. But it's, you know, just think of it as, you know, a journey starts with one step, right? You don't have to have perfect privacy or perfect security. I think most people, if they would just install some ad blockers, they would already get into like the top 99% of privacy of most people on the internet. And if you just install any halfway decent password manager, don't use your browser's password manager. Like, use something like 1Password or Bitwarden or KeePass. I mean, there's a lot of them out there.
Open source. Look for open source.
Yeah. Now, if you're using a password manager, because really you should only know 1Password, and that is the password to your password manager.
Really?
Your password manager should be generating and storing all of these other passwords for you. Oh. And you can secure your password manager with a hardware device like a YubiKey.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, nothing, like you said, nothing is perfectly secure. Even the password manager could get compromised somehow. There have been password.
I think 1Pass.
LastPass was compromised, kind of. It was a cryptographic weakness. Like, it didn't compromise everybody who was using LastPass. It was actually only compromised people who had weak master passwords. So that 1Password to log you into your password manager should be, you know, probably 20 plus characters, you know, something memorable. And you only have to memorize that one.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. This is such good advice. I can't wait to do our webinar. If people are interested in Casa, I highly recommend it. Happy customer. Casa.io/Natalie, you'll get a discounted plan. I also recommend, if you want hand-holding through it, Casa can do that. Bitcoin Way can do that. There's a lot of great resources. I have tutorials online too. So I think these episodes are so important. So Jameson, thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode of Coin Stories. Make sure you're subscribed to the show so you don't miss any new episodes. If you can, turn on those notifications and leave us a positive review. It really helps the show grow organically with new listeners. We have a free weekly newsletter. You can sign up at thenewsblock.substack.com. And remember, this show is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should constitute as official investment advice, and you should always do your own research. I'm always open to feedback and guest suggestions, so please feel free to reach out at info@talkingbitcoin.com. I'll see you next time.